That's right, Dreadlock Man by Something Ska from the All-Scanadian Club Volume 2, which our very own intrepid community journalist Danny discovered the existence of, rediscovered the existence of, after I told him that that my uncle was in a band with that name that I'm just going to assume is the same band. How many different Something Skas can there be?
In Vancouver as well, I think. Honestly, when I looked into it, I looked up Something Ska Band, and then I looked up Something Ska Vancouver, and I didn't find anything. And then when I just Googled Something Ska, like, the seventh result was a Discogs posting for this Scanadian compilation, and that's how I found it.
Yeah, and by the magic of Campus Community Radio, we have a copy.
We just had it digitized already.
Which is great. Danny, as that song was playing, we had Connor in the station skanking, which is the traditional ska dance, and we were talking about the pick it ups and the chick and the tropes of ska, which you were new to. You, what is your knowledge of ska? Like, when someone says ska, what do you know?
Oh man, I there seems to be jazz elements, that seems to be a thing. I think it derives from forms of reggae and that kind of music, but honestly, other than that, I know very little about ska.
Believe it or not, reggae comes from ska.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's all a little muddy, but there's dub and there's reggae, all sort of rooted in sort of Caribbean, Jamaican music, bringing in jazz with the horns and all of that, but there's also a sort of punk influence.
Right, okay.
And there's always been a big sort of, like, a big part of ska has always been diversity and racial unity. The sort of the icon of ska is the checkerboard, a black and white checkerboard, so representing sort of black and white people together in one thing. Anyway, in high school, I was super into ska, mostly because I played the trumpet, and that was, like, the closest adjacent musical genre that I could work my way into that was somewhat, in my mind, cool, but turns out not mainstream cool.
Alternative, though, and you said it's punk adjacent. I don't think any other punk band is going to allow a trumpet.
Yeah, well, you'd be surprised. There was also in the 90s a big pushback against horns and ska in punk bands. Propaganda has a song called Ska Sucks. That is in itself a ska song. So it's a little, anyway. That's all immaterial. I wanted to invite you in to introduce the piece that you worked on our way to the conference.
Yeah, that was... So this is an interview I'd been wanting to get for a while, just because I thought the topic around it was really fascinating. The Tsleil-Waututh Nation recently posted about their bull kelp restoration project, which they had been doing in 2023 and 2024 in North Vancouver area, sort of, so like Cates Park and Brighton Park. And since the restoration project has started, they've actually seen a lot of success. And, you know, I love a success story, and especially one that has to do not just with, you know, local ecosystems, but there was also a very clear sort of cultural and educational aspect to it as well, you know, introducing the nation's youth to the role that bull kelp play within our ecosystem. And there was a lot of really cool things that I learned throughout the interview. I was able to speak with Michelle George, who is the nation's cultural and technical specialist. And I was really, really glad that she was willing to speak to me over Zoom on a ferry ride when I had two bars of data. So that was lovely. And that is the interview. So I hope you all enjoy.
Cool. Well, without further ado, we're going to jump right into that. Thanks, Danny.
So my name is Michelle George. I work for Tsleil-Waututh Nation. I'm a cultural and technical specialist, and we have a number of programs within the Treaty Lands and Resources Department, specifically land, water, and environment. And through that program, we have initiatives like restoration projects or habitat enhancement projects. And that's where the bull kelp restoration comes into play. So Slavetooth has been doing restoration projects for over the last 30 years, and it's a part of our initiative to clean up the waterways and surrounding lands. And so we've done restoration projects in estuaries and stuff, and we've been focusing on kelp and eelgrass. And specifically, this kelp project is sort of the first of its kind for us. So we're learning the process, how to harvest kelp from other areas, how to transplant it into new areas that aren't growing it. And it's sort of also a learning process for us. The methods for transplanting include securing kelp onto ceramic plates, to put it simply, and then putting those on the seabed and hoping that they flower and seed new bull kelp. And that's a really high-level, non-technical overview of the project.
Thank you. I think that does a good job of summarizing it all. Aside from the restoration aspect of the project, I wanted to know if there was also an educational part as well, particularly with the youth of the Tsleil-Waututh Nation, regarding the history and the importance of kelp within these ecosystems.
So Tsleil-Waututh have used Burrard Inlet since time out of mind. And so we used it for transportation, cultural activities, and food. And then up until 1792, we used it freely and every day. Unfortunately, after contact, that changed. And a lot of other industrial colonizing practices changed the way that we use the waterways. And so because of the pollution and devastation, some of our members don't access the waterways as they once did, or understand some of the resources that we used to harvest from the waterways. So a part of that is bringing community, specifically our school kids, out to these restoration areas and having them participate in these projects. Not specifically related to kelp, but we did have our students out there tying eelgrass to washers to sink them into the other projects that we've done. And so their hands-on approach, not only did they actually get to learn about the bull kelp and other kelps, traditional practices, traditional uses, and then also getting them out on the land with elders and other knowledge holders so that there's cultural exchange and education going on as well. So scientifically, but then also culturally, they're learning from all levels of not only our employees, but elders and community members.
Another thing that I found really fascinating about this project had to do with how this kelp restoration is sort of working against certain current forces, whether that be the ongoing effects of colonization or how that connects to climate change, which is ever present. And I also know that this is not the first attempt with this restoration project. There was a previous attempt in a past year that wasn't as successful. How did the nation sort of adapt and change the strategies around the restoration project in order for it to become more of a success?
Well, I think doing a little of the monitoring, assessing where we put it, where we selected sites, and then knowing what kind of ecosystem kelp needs to flourish in. So having multiple sites is in a way beneficial and helps the production of it. And then having, in a sense, more options, different scenarios where it has a chance to succeed, and then understanding where it's not succeeding so that we don't replant there or waste attempts there.
And is there a specific site in particular where you're seeing the most success?
I believe our out of the sites that we picked, I think New Brighton's one of the more successful sites.
Another thing I found really interesting about this project had to do with the various ways that kelp restoration can help these ecosystems, you know, whether that be increasing local sea life populations or even the way that the kelp moves in the water, helping guide boats in the area historically. I was wondering if that's something you've been seeing and if that's something you can speak to.
I'm not sure if it's like completely related to boating, but I definitely see it ecology wise. Whole point of kelp and restoring the waterways is to help the forage fish. The forage fish are a major player within the food web, and is the herring. So in the 1860s, herring was completely harvested, exasperated from Burrard Inlet due to dynamite fishing. And it wasn't really known that it was such a huge part of Tsleil-Waututh diet that because it wasn't available for the last 100 years plus. And in the last 4 to 5 years, we've had a major herring return within Burrard Inlet. And I think that also attributes to the return of killer whales within Burrard Inlet as well. So herring and killer whales, which we haven't seen in decades, have started to return to Burrard Inlet. So in a sense, those killer whales are probably having more of an effect on the boating than our kelp project, but I think they're interconnected.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is that the kelp restoration is helping with the local herring populations, which is in turn benefiting the local killer whales as well as other sea life.
I believe so.
Do you hope that this project is able to inspire other communities to adopt similar restoration practices?
Well, we do. In Tsleil-Waututh in general, we have a lot of initiatives going on. We have water quality, we have restoration. We're doing a number of things, and I think we always put it back to the people that use the area. Are you doing your part, thinking about green energy, doing things differently, waste? And depending on how specific we want to get, it even goes into the way that you wash your clothes and the types of material that you use, because microplastics are a real thing. And what people don't know is that it comes from your laundry. So understanding that a lot of things are really interconnected, and everybody has a little bit to participate in. And even when you go to a beach, understanding that it is an ecosystem and that walking in the tidal area could be effectively stomping on someone's home. When I refer to someone, I mean resources, wildlife, marine environment.
Mm-hmm. So just being more mindful of the role that we all play within this ecosystem and the ways that we can sort of equitably coexist.
Yes, exactly. We're all neighbors and we all sort of have to live together, so yeah.
Thank you to Danny for putting together that interview here on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. This is Speak Up. It's still me, Jesse. I had earlier mentioned that I was going to try to play you Robin Erickson's keynote address from the Community Radio Awards, the Community Radio Awards for Broadcasting and Online, but we don't have time, and I don't want to cut Robin off, so we'll save that for another week. And instead, I got something else for you, but first we're going to play a little bit more local music. This is CJSF Sweethearts, The Houseplants, with their track Dreams of Falling. of Falling by the Houseplants here on Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. I'm Jesse. Democracy Now! Is up in about 10 minutes. So we are going to hear a report from CICK in Smithers about one of their breweries being named the best one of those in the country. Way to go!
This is CICK News. Today on CICK News, Smithers Brewing Company, only 7 years old this year, was awarded Canadian Brewery of the Year at the Canadian Brewing Awards in Vancouver last week, where the very best in craft breweries across the country gather to have their beer judged by a panel of industry experts. This year's competition featured more than 1,600 entries from nearly 270 breweries spanning 50 categories from traditional English ale to spicier offerings like chili beer. Smithers Brewing Company won bronze in the Irish Stout category, silvers in the Creative, Scotch Ale, and Berliner Weiss and Gose category, and two golds came home to Smithers in the Irish Red as well as English Mild and Brown Ale category. Here's Smithers Brewing Company's head brewer, Cam McKeegan, talking to CICK News last Tuesday.
We didn't figure out, like, until at the gala when the awards were being doled out, one of the organizers pulled me aside and he's like, have you figured it out yet? And like, no, figured one out. And, brewery of the year, do you have a speech ready? I'm like, do I have a what? My name's Cam McKeegan. I am the head brewer and part owner of Smithers Brewing Company.
Okay. Canadian Brewery of the Year. What do you think that this does for, one, the brewery, and then, two, for Smithers to bring home a title like that?
I mean, for the brewery, it kind of puts us on the craft beer map. Us and a lot of our friends up here are often overlooked in the craft beer scene just because we're so damn hard to get to.
Yeah.
So it does kind of, like, at the very least, there are a lot of people around Canada right now and in BC, you know, looking at Google Maps and being like, oh, that's where Smithers is. But, yeah, I don't know, it just kind of, like, both for the town and for the brewery, it sort of just puts us on the map. And for the town, it does it about a week after Tony Hawk was here. So it's just like all of a sudden people are not only going to be Googling where is Smithers, but they're like, what are they doing up there?
How likely did you think it was going to be that you were going to, was it six?
It was six medals. And the Brewery of the Year is just, like, it goes to the brewery that brings home the most individual medals. So, yeah. Like, we didn't know we'd won six. So we didn't go into it kind of like, oh, yeah, I think we got this in the bag. The Canadian Brewing Awards, they kind of give you the nod, and they're sort of like, hey, it would be a good idea for you to attend. And also, if you could bring a couple of these beers, and they list the beers, mm-hmm. It would be like, you know, it would be beneficial. We'd really appreciate it if you could bring some of these beers for us all to drink. And so that kind of tells you that, like, those beers have won awards. But they kind of didn't give us much more than that. We didn't figure out, like, until at the gala when the awards were being doled out, one of the organizers pulled me aside. And he's like, have you figured it out yet? Like, no. Figured one out. Brewery of the Year, do you have a speech ready? I'm like, do I have a what? He's like, oh, well, we're going to announce it in, like, 20 minutes. So, like, you better start working on your speech.
So the beers that you won for, were they mostly like traditional styles? What's the secret to crafting something beautifully that a lot of people know what it tastes like and what it should taste like?
I mean, the thing with those beers is it kind of isn't a secret. Like, a handful of those styles have been around for well over a century, some of them longer than that. And they're recipes of the big breweries that have, like, that are famous for producing those styles are readily available on the internet. And it's more just kind of technique and process and, you know, sourcing the ingredients from the places where, you know, like, the beer is from. Like, our Irish Red and our Irish Stout both won medals in this recent one, and we bring in malt from the British Isles, we bring in hops from the British Isles, right? And we adjust our water profile to be more or less like, I use cork water. I don't use Dublin water. Cork, for those of you who aren't sure, Cork is a county in Ireland, as well as a city in Ireland. I don't put actual corks in the water. But, yeah, it is just, like, taking the time, doing the research, getting the fine details right, and going through enough of the research where, you know, I didn't just copy and paste a recipe for any of these beers. It was just going through the research and finding the respected brewers who had, like, put literature on the internet and kind of synthesizing my own take on everything that's already out there. As far as, like, you know, we're kind of known in the industry as, or like in our little corner of the industry as kind of like beer lunatics, and like we're doing, you know, weird stuff. And, you know, my philosophy with that has always been, well, learn how to do the base beer properly first, and then, you know, once you've got the base beer that tasting a certain way and you're happy with it, what else works on top of or in conjunction with the flavors of that base beer. And so even our wildest stuff has a good foundation underneath it. And that's the stuff that we advertise a little bit more and we bring to beer festivals and stuff. Like, that reputation is well earned. Like, we try and be a bit weird about things. But I am pretty happy that 5 of the 6 medals were for traditional styles, because it kind of showcases the other side of our brewery, which is when we want to take a run at something that's very well established, we look at the style guidelines. We taste the beers from the breweries that made those styles famous, and we, you know, we let that inform how the beer is going to go here moving forward.
Well, congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
CSK News is funded by the Government of Canada, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and is a participating station in the Local Journalism Initiative. On behalf of my colleague Dan Messick and myself, Pam Hassan, thanks for listening.
Thanks to Pam, Dan, and CICK and the Local Journalism Initiative for sharing that with us. And now we're going to wrap up the show with something totally wild that I discovered due to a YouTube algorithm. That's right. And a shout out to Connor, who did our interview earlier this show with Jennifer from the DLARC and is host of Bitcoover, which plays all sorts of chiptune music. We're going to hear a track from Illiness, a chiptune tribute to Sufjan Stevens' seminal record, Come On, Feel the Illinois. We're going to hear the title track, Come On, Feel the Illinois. Democracy Now! Is up next. See you next week.